Ladies and gentlemen, the Theosophical Society has much pleasure in presenting Mr. Geoffrey Hodson, international lecturer and author, in a talk entitled Reincarnation, Fact or Fallacy.
Friends, the doctrine of reincarnation, or rebirth in many lives, has a large place in theosophical philosophy and science. What does reincarnation really imply? Perhaps an adequate description of it would be, man evolves to perfection by means of successive lives on earth. I think that's a good way to put it. We, each one of us, evolve gradually to perfection by means of successive lives on earth. Belief in reincarnation is almost universal throughout the Orient. Although the doctrine is gradually gaining acceptance in the West, many people object strongly to the idea. Are their objections valid? Is there an alternative theory which explains human experience with equal logic? Does the apparent absence of the teaching of reincarnation from Orthodox Christianity constitute a weakness? Let us look at these questions together. As a lecturer for the Theosophical Society, traveling all over the world and teaching this doctrine, naturally I meet with a great many objections, and I find that one of the commonest is that which arises from a shrinking from life in the flesh and from the suffering which is man's lot at this stage of human evolution. So many people say, I don't want to come back here again. Once is enough for me. One cannot but sympathize with those whose experience of life has been so unfortunate as to bring them to such a conclusion. Nevertheless, according to the true doctrine of reincarnation, the objection is invalid. It's misconceived. For, and it's important to get this very clear in our minds, for by rebirth is not implied the return to earth of our present named selves. We, as we know of ourselves, do not reincarnate. This personal self with its bodily and mental characteristics, its name, race, creed, sex, and outlook, this mortal person does not reincarnate. Theosophy teaches, and this is founded, of course, upon occult investigation, repeatedly checked throughout vast ages. Theosophy teaches that at death, the temporary mortal body is finally laid aside to reappear no more. And later on, this also becomes true for the bodies of emotion and of mind after death. They disintegrate and disappear. That which down here we generally regard as ourselves is not in reality our true selves at all. It's one of the great mistakes, you know, that we make, and it brings so much difficulty upon us. We identify ourselves with our bodies instead of with our spiritual souls. The real self of man is an eternal, immortal spiritual being, quite distinct from the physical body. Being immortal and eternal, it does not, it cannot die. The body, the physical body, on the other hand, being but mortal, inevitably passes away. It had a beginning and it must have an end. According to the real doctrine of reincarnation, it is this, the immortal pilgrim God within the body which reincarnates, and not the mortal bodily man with his transient feelings and thoughts. When therefore we think and say in objection to rebirth, I do not want to return, we need have no fear. We, as we normally know ourselves, do not return. It is the divine essence, the spiritual self with its acquired individual attributes and its spiritual progress which reincarnates. A further objection to reincarnation, I find, is based upon the mistaken idea that reincarnation might imply transmigration of souls from human into animal forms. This also is an entirely erroneous view of the doctrine, and consequently, as an objection, it is invalid. When once the life, the inner life in any form, has attained to a certain level of unfoldment, although there may be delay or digression, there is no real retrogression. Men are not reborn as herd instinct animals. The mind may also shrink from accepting the idea of reincarnation on the ground that rebirth will so separate loved ones as to preclude all possibility of future reunion. One can well understand that, can't one? But this objection in its turn, strangely enough, is invalid. Neither birth nor death nor rebirth can ever completely and finally separate those between whom a deep and strong spiritual, intellectual, or physical bond has been formed. In their spiritual selves, wherein the closest affinity has been established, those who love, I mean really love, deeply love, they are forever at one, whether physically embodied or disembodied, at any given time. In the state of consciousness in which the spiritual self of man abides, painful separation is impossible. Parting is unknown. Furthermore, and this is another answer to the objection, furthermore, the very fact of the existence of so close a bond will cause those who love to descend repeatedly into incarnation at about the same time. And then, under the law of cause and effect, they will find rebirth under conditions in which they're likely to meet again. They then will be drawn together by their affinity and by the law of cause and effect. On meeting again, although the new brain, the seat of memory, may not remember the incidents of past intimate associations, the heart often speaks, a mutual and often inexplicable attraction is felt. Later, love may be renewed. Sometimes it happens at first sight. Once more, a close relationship, differing in character perhaps in various incarnations, is established. And this may be parental, filial, fraternal, or between comrades and colleagues. In each new association, life after life, love deepens. Love grows more unselfish, more noble, until at last the state is reached of love perfected, which is life perfected. Another objection to reincarnation is based upon the apparent absence of all memory of past lives. A little reflection will show, however, that recollection of the process of education is in no sense essential to possession of the acquired knowledge and faculty. We don't need to remember the processes of learning to walk, talk, read, and write, in order to be able to do these things. Similarly, the absence of memory of incidents and experiences in past lives does not prevent the use of the resultant powers in later physical incarnations. Actually, the reincarnating ego does retain both the full memory of all incidents of past life cycles and all the capacities which have been attained. Furthermore, just as remembrance of childish struggles when learning to walk, talk, read, and write is rarely retained in adult life, so recollection of the multifarious educative experiences of numerous preceding lives is not generally permitted to descend into the new brain. In consequence, the weight of the drama of previous existences is withheld, and the mind is left free to investigate and to assimilate new ideas. This withholding of memory may have been implied in classical references to the river Lethe, the waters of forgetfulness, you may remember. The river Lethe, which has to be crossed in the after-death world on the way back to rebirth. Indeed, there's a truth there. The fruits of former lives are, however, expressed in each new personality. They come through, shall I say, as instinct and inherent gifts. That's a wrong word, of course, because every power has to be worked for. As sympathies, and they come through as sympathies and antipathies, and as the voice of conscience. In these ways, the memory does come to us in each new life. But you know, there are many proven accounts of accurate memory of earlier lives, and in such cases, such memories have been proven to be true, and they thereby constitute strong additional evidence in support of the idea of rebirth. Whilst, however, the only final proof of the truth of reincarnation consists of direct knowledge of one's own past, there is convincing evidence to be found in a book by a certain Colonel de Rocha, a French doctor and military man. He calls his book Les Vies Successives, Successive Lives. In that book, Colonel de Rocha describes experiments with various sensitives put into a trance state by hypnotism. By the process known as regression of memory, the operators succeeded in taking their subjects back to former incarnations, thus obtaining details, often of an historical character, which when checked were found to be entirely correct. In that book, I remember, in one typical instance, the sensitive chosen for an experiment was a young servant girl, with little or no education and but a rudimentary knowledge of history. When led back in this way to a preceding life, she described correctly and with a wealth of detail historical events, little known incidents, ancient customs and other matters of which she was completely ignorant in her present incarnation. Yet her descriptions were perfectly true. Recorded instances of children who in full waking consciousness remember details of their past lives possess an even greater evidential value. These cases, for the most part, deal with children who, dying in their earlier years, are almost immediately reborn, thus making more likely the recollection of their former lives. So it is that certain fundamental objections to the doctrine of rebirth are, on examination, found to be without much substance and need not in the least prevent acceptance of the idea of rebirth on purely logical grounds. So one of the oldest and most universal of all human beliefs is that man gradually evolves to perfection through successive lives lived here on earth. This, as my title and words to you, say this is the doctrine of reincarnation. And as I've been saying, one part of the evidence in its support consists of tested memories of former lives. Let me tell you of some of them. I know personally about some of them, but here are a few collected from reliable sources. You know, such memories of former lives are far more common than is generally realized. People don't like talking about them because they're liable to be laughed at, aren't they? But when one begins to examine the doctrine of reincarnation critically, and to search for evidence for it and against it, one does find numbers of recorded instances of clear recollection of former lives, which of some of which have been susceptible of test and proof by means of historical records. Here is an interesting case. An officer in the Indian Army remembered distinctly being a high official in the court of one of the pharaohs. He was an English officer in the Indian army. In his dream, in his memory really, he fell in love with a dancing girl, but the disparity of their social positions made marriage so far impossible. So he and the dancing girl fled one night into the Theban desert. They'd hardly got clear of the city before they were overtaken by a sandstorm. Before he could wrap her burnous round her mouth and nose, the sand enveloped them, and they were both suffocated. Often and often did he have the old feeling of choking, as though repeating this supreme incident in the past so vividly in his mind, but he never met the girl. One night, however, he was at a conversazione of the Royal Society in London. Knowing no one, as he thought, looking round, he saw a girl leaning against the wall, staring at him. Something impelled him to move towards her, and he did so. She simultaneously moved towards him across the room. It's very dramatic, this story. When she reached him, she put out both her hands and said, "Suffocated." "What?" he said. "Do you remember too?" "Yes, indeed," she said, "and how you tried to wrap my scarf round my mouth." Now there is an unusual case where two people had the same memory of an earlier life. By the by, I mustn't leave you in suspense. Yes, they are married now. Here's a case from India. In the latter half of 1922, a three-year-old Indian boy named Vishwanath of Bareilly, India, surprised his parents by giving them minute details of what he claimed was his previous life. The boy pestered his father about a place called Pilibhit, wanting to know how far it was from Bareilly, his new home, and begging his father to take him there. His father and mother, believing quite erroneously that children with such memories die young, yes, quite erroneously, tried everything in their power to make the boy forget his strange fancies. But as he grew older, his preoccupation with his past life grew more intense. So, yielding to the boy's entreaties, his parents took him to the government high school at Pilibhit. The boy said he didn't recognize the school. In fact, it was a quite new building. The boy then astounded his hearers with a wealth of information about his previous life in that town. He said his neighbour had been a Lafa Sundar Lal, who boasted a green gate, a sword and a gun, and who held nautch parties in the courtyard of his house. He said his father had been a landowner with great fondness for wine, fish and nautch girls. He claimed, this boy did, that he'd studied in the government school, passing in Urdu, Hindi and English, and reaching the sixth class. All this was subsequently confirmed as entirely correct. He described the house in which he'd lived, including its interior, and when taken to the building, everything was found exactly as he'd described it, including the position of a staircase. The little boy put his finger correctly upon a man in a group photograph as being Ha Narai, finally capping his amazing memory of another life by pointing to himself, a boy seated in a chair. That boy in the photograph was none other than Lakshmi Narain, son of Babu Nai Narain, who had died, the boy had, of lung trouble in December 15, 1918 at the age of 32. Among other details given quite correctly were the exact site of class 6 in the local school, the appearance of his teacher, the names of places where he'd worked, and the name of his personal servant. The boy's maternal uncle, still living, corroborated many of these statements, including facts everyone else had forgotten. Isn't that an interesting case? And if I had time, I could tell you many more. I've met some of them in India myself and in other parts of the world. Admittedly, however, physical remembrance of incidents of past lives is very rare. But of memory, as far as innate capacity and knowledge are concerned, there is complete evidence in both the animal and the human kingdoms of nature. One theosophical explanation of animal instinct is that in some cases it's a form of recollection. the soul, or the life consciousness, shall we call it, evolving through ducklings, for example, has evolved through other ducks in earlier times, and so knows instinctively that ducks can swim. In the new brain, the ducklings do not remember those previous existences, but they have brought over the instinct which results from them, and so quite naturally they swim. All instinctive habits and customs in the animal kingdom may well be similarly attributable to race memory. You may have noticed that domestic animals often repeat old habits which belong to their earlier phases of evolution, when they were still in the wild state. The dog, for example, will frequently turn round and round before he lies down. This is because in earlier days, as a wolf, he had need to tread down his jungle or forest bed in order to make it comfortable. Like the duckling, he doesn't remember the incidents, but he follows his instinct. Often, though, in his case, the need for the action no longer exists. In much the same instinctive fashion, we human beings remember our past lives, our inherent gifts, as I said, actually hard-won faculties, our natural sympathies and our antipathies, our remembrances of the past. Love at first sight, as I said, that love which springs suddenly into existence and may last for a lifetime, is but the spontaneous renewal of an ancient tie. There are others for whom we feel an inborn aversion, which also has its roots in other lives when the relationship was not a happy one. We thus bring with us into each new incarnation intuitive rather than detailed memory of old associations and activities and achievements. And the fruits of these experiences manifest themselves in the new personality as innate faculties, sympathies and antipathies, which would otherwise be difficult to explain. There, friends, I must leave this fascinating subject, hoping that I've shown you that the objections which normally arise in our mind to acceptance of the doctrine of spiritual evolution to the stature of the perfect man through successive lives on earth, these objections are not really valid, and they need not prevent us from accepting this age-old and magnificent idea. With it is generally associated the operation of the law of cause and effect, which links these lives together. As St. Paul put it, as whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And one might presume to add, if not in that life, then in the lives which follow after. Thus, friends, human evolution, human progress continues. Reincarnation provides us with ample time, ample experience in which to grow, life by life, nearer and nearer to that glorious goal which St. Paul described as to come unto the perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And through it all, the operation of the law of cause and effect ensures for each and every one complete and perfect justice, every action producing its own appropriate reaction. And finally, we are inspired by the knowledge that success in this great pilgrimage towards perfection is assured to every human being by virtue of the presence and the action within him of the Divine Spirit, the Christ in him, his hope of glory, that God within us to which St. Paul referred, that God that worketh in us and will ultimately bring us to our glorious goal.